this is History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story is, what was the most important invention in history? Our team of historians, broadcasters, and authors named the discoveries that have transformed our world over the centuries, compiled by Isabel King. First, writing, spreading the word, and nationalism. Were it not for the invention of writing, I would be offering this answer via megaphone. Writing is nowhere near as old as humanity's 300,000-year history, but it is old. The first writing system emerged in Mesopotamia around 3200 BC. Separate systems developed in Micronesia in the 1800s BC, Shang Dynasty China around 1300 BC, and in Mesoamerica after 900 BC. Although writing did not supplant oral tradition, it did dramatically extend the reach of communications and allow groups to write down and diffuse their histories, ideas, lores, and laws. The invention and refinement of writing changed the relationship between memory and record, as well as people's sense of reachable world. Complex societies existed before and apart from the development of writing, but writing made societies easier to administer over distance. For better or worse, it allowed the development of bureaucracy. The esteemed political scientist Benedict Anderson saw it as fundamental to how communities understood themselves in place and time. He argued that the emergence of print media in the modern era, writing circulated fast and far, produced a simultaneity of experience that allowed people to see themselves as part of a cohesive community even when they could not encounter everyone in it. In other words, as set out in Imagined Communities, Reflections on the Origin and Spread of Nationalism, 1983, it allowed for the emergence of nationalism that has had global consequences. Adrian Lentz-Smith is Associate Professor of History at Duke University. Second, Roman concrete, mixing things up to build bigger and better. The Pantheon in Rome should not exist, or at least not in the form we see it today. Its perfect concrete dome, spanning 43 meters and pierced by a great oculus eye, still stands almost 2 millennia after it was poured and remains the largest unreinforced concrete dome in the world. Step inside and you confront not only Roman architectural brilliance, but the single most transformative invention in Roman history, Roman concrete. Concrete itself was not a Roman discovery. Nabataean builders were using early forms of it as far back as 6500 BC. But around 300 BC, Roman engineers revolutionized the material by mixing volcanic ash with lime and water, often transported from the Bay of Naples. This created a hydraulic concrete that could set underwater and, remarkably, grow stronger over time. The Pantheon's immense unsupported dome is the most dramatic advertisement of this achievement. It's a structure that has resisted earthquakes, fire, invasions, and centuries of continuous use, all thanks to the material's durability. The material is even able to self-heal when exposed to water. Once armed with concrete, Roman builders were no longer bound by the limitations of cut stone. They created vast basilicas, monumental bath complexes, sweeping amphitheaters, such as the Colosseum, and harbors. Concrete turned Rome into a vertical metropolis of multi-story apartment buildings, housing tens of thousands of residents. It also enabled the construction of aqueducts, bridges, and warehouses to create infrastructure that stitched the empire together. Roman concrete was the foundation of an architectural revolution, one that shaped the physical world of the Romans and continues to astonish and inspire us today. Jess Fenner is an ancient historian, presenter, and author. Third, antibiotics, antibacterial lifesavers that transformed medicine. Of all the incredible inventions that have benefited humanity over the centuries, none has been more important or saved more lives than the creation of antibiotic medicines. Before antibiotics, you could die from even the smallest of infections. A paper cut could kill you. Women routinely died in childbirth, often from infection. Their children fared no better. In 1900, 1 in 5 children in the UK died before they were 5 years old. Many diseases had no cure. The biggest killer in the late 19th century was tuberculosis. It infected up to 90% of the urban population in Europe and North America, and the only treatment for it was fresh air. All of this changed with the invention of antibiotics. After sulfur-based antibiotics were first introduced in the United States in the 1930s, deaths during childbirth dropped by a third, and deaths from scarlet fever by two-thirds. The mass production of penicillin in the 1940s had even more impressive results. For the first time, silent killers such as tuberculosis could be completely cured, along with a whole list of other diseases too long to mention. According to one study, antibiotics have added an average of 20 years to our life expectancies across the globe. But one can have too much of a good thing. Because antibiotics were so effective, they were overprescribed right from the start. Some bacteria are now developing resistance to our drugs. Unless we are careful, we risk a return to the day when a simple cough or a paper cut could be the prelude to something much, much worse. Keith Lowe is the author of Fear and the Freedom, How the Second World War Changed Us. 4. The steam engine, hot stuff, history's most pumped-up changemaker. The invention of steam power was in many ways iterative, but the production of a steam engine by Baptist preacher and ironmonger Thomas Newcomen in 1712 was a transformative moment. Born in Devon, Newcomen was acutely aware of the problems of flooding in tin mines in the Southwest, and the first steam engine was designed to pump water out of the mines. In 1765, his design was refined by James Watt, who added a separate vessel for condensation. This meant an engine's main cylinder could remain hot while steam condensed in a separate cold chamber. As a result, machines could be both scaled down and made more powerful. Over the next 150 years, refinements were made and the principles of thermodynamics came to be further understood, paving the way for modern engineering and cosmology. The steam engine, of course, powered the Industrial Revolution. Factories, trains, and ships were all driven by steam power, and it ushered in political, social, and cultural transformations. In many ways, steam facilitated Britain's global dominance. Patterns of labor were turned on their head, and many courageously protested as they found wages lowered, inequities exacerbated, and capital concentrated in the hands of those who owned the technology. Hannah Skoda is Associate Professor of Medieval History at the University of Oxford. 5. The World Wide Web, the brainchild of Britain's greatest surfer dude. The most important invention of my lifetime has been the World Wide Web. At university in the early 1900s, it was essentially the preserve of computing enthusiasts and science students. By the end of the decade, even the most dry-as-dust history professors had been persuaded of the benefits of Sir Tim Berners-Lee's big idea. It's easy to see why. As more of the world's archives have been put online, research has been transformed out of all recognition. The most obscure book or article can be located in seconds. Voluminous texts that would have taken months to wade through can be searched in an instant. Information and ideas can be shared in real time between scholars working on opposite sides of the globe. Alas, in the past decade or so, we have seen the downsides. A tool designed for the sharing of information can also be used to spread misinformation. Algorithms are tweaked so that the truth is suppressed and propaganda is promoted. Malevolent actors can rig elections, distort polls, and even topple governments. The internet has led to measurable increases in division, racism, and fascism. Will the good outweigh the bad? Right now, as was famously but mistakenly said of the French Revolution, it is too soon to tell. Either way, when historians of the future are asked to name transformative inventions, the World Wide Web will be towards the top of their lists. Mark Morris is a medieval historian, writer, and broadcaster. You're listening to History Extra on Sunsounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our next story is Rome's People Power, from Romulus's open city policy to Claudius's reforms. Citizenship was used by Rome as both a reward and a weapon. And as Sheshma Malik explains, it enabled the burgeoning empire to build power and define identity. What made Rome so powerful? Writing in the early 16th century in his Discourses on Livy, Niccolo Machiavelli argued that the secret lay not in geography or in luck, but in people, and in a ruthless exhibility in acquiring them. Those who design a city to create a great empire must strive with great diligence to fill it full of inhabitants, he wrote. This may be done in two ways, either through love or through force. It is done through love by keeping the pathways open and safe for foreigners who wish to come there to live. It is done through force after nearby cities are destroyed by sending their inhabitants to live in your city. Rome enlarged its population through both of those two methods, enabling it to build enormous fighting forces. Machiavelli cited a figure of 80,000 men, compared with just 20,000 for Athens or Sparta at their peak. Rome flourished, said Machiavelli, not because it had an advantageous location, but because of one simple but powerful policy. It made outsiders into Romans. This concept was integral to the city's founding story. Romans were not from Rome, as Athenians were thought to be born from the earth of Athens, but traveled and settled there as refugees. According to myth, especially Virgil's epic, the Aeneid, Aeneas came to Italy after fleeing from a burning Troy. Romulus and Remus, twins, supposedly descended from the line of kings that traced back to Aeneas' son, were rescued from certain death at the hands of their great uncle and sent floating down the Tiber in a basket. Rescued and suckled by the she-wolf, they were then raised by herdsman Faustulus and his wife, Acca Laurentia. The twins founded Rome, but after an episode of brutal fratricide, Romulus became the sole ruler. One of his first acts, according to the historian Livy, was to offer asylum to all those, free or enslaved, from the surrounding areas who wanted a fresh start, recruiting them to join his new city. The first Roman senators were selected from among these early Romans. Becoming Roman. This origin myth was created in part to highlight the fact that citizenship could be transferred. You did not need to be born a Roman to become a Roman. As Machiavelli observed, this was also a deeply pragmatic strategy for accumulating the manpower needed to build an empire. However, it is not the case that all those who entered into the empire, in particular those conquered by the Romans, became citizens. Rome was an empire of citizens, but not necessarily Roman citizens. When Rome was expanding into Italy, especially in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC, grants of citizenship could be offered as reward or imposed as punishment for those unwilling to comply with its demands. Gifts of citizenship could also, on occasion, be refused if the proposed grantees did not see the benefits. This was a case of a group of soldiers from central Italy who helped the Romans to defend Casilinum from attack by the Carthaginian general Hannibal. Livy describes how the soldiers were rewarded with double pay and an extraordinary 5-year exemption from military service. However, when they were offered citizenship, the men refused, preferring instead to keep their status as citizens of Praeneste. This story reminds us that we should not take for granted the desirability of Roman citizenship over others when Rome was expanding as a republic, or later when it was under the control of emperors. During the Republic, citizenship was technically in the gift of the Roman citizen body. However, this changed in the late Republic when generals such as Pompey and Caesar, and later Octavian and Antony, could grant citizenship on the basis of military merit. Balbus, born in Gades, had fought with the Romans in various battles against the rebel general Sertorius. Cicero, one of Balbus's team of defenders, had a seemingly clear-cut case that not only did Balbus deserve citizenship, but that Pompey unquestionably had the authority to grant it. What the trial reveals, however, are the political stakes of citizenship grants in the changing landscape of the Roman Republic. In the later period of the 1st century BC, citizenship, like many other aspects of a Roman status, had become a tool of political attack. Rights and responsibilities. What did citizenship get you? The first thing to remember is that both men and women were Roman citizens. This is underlined by the right of connubium, of Roman women and men to marry and have children. Roman citizens also had the right to enter into contracts, such as trade with other Romans and with the protection of the Roman courts. In addition, Romans had the right to appeal if they were being mistreated. Perhaps the most famous example of this is an episode in the New Testament book of Acts 22:25, in which Paul, affirming his status as a Roman citizen, insisted on being taken to Rome. The story goes that the apostle was arrested in Jerusalem for creating a disturbance. The barracks commander ordered him to be flogged, but the centurion had to stop when Paul declared himself a Roman citizen. Even more pointedly, it's observed that Paul had been born a Roman citizen, whereas the centurion had bought his citizenship. Ultimately, Paul declared to Festus, the procurator of Judea, his right to go to Rome and plead his case. "You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go," was Festus's response, reaccounted in Acts 25:12. In political terms, during the Republic and early imperial period, men who held Roman citizenship had the right to vote in Rome's assemblies and to run for magistracies if they could afford it. But this did not extend to women, or, in the main, to citizens who had been manumitted from enslavement. It also did not extend to men from communities who had been granted citizenship without voting rights, a status first recorded in the 4th century BC. As well as rights, citizens also had duties, which included taxation and military service. There were a number of ways to become a Roman citizen other than being born to parents who possessed the right of connubium. If an enslaved person was manumitted by a Roman citizen in one of three legally defined ways, a person could be granted citizenship. Those who held a magistracy, political office in a Latin community, a colony that was subject to Latin law, with some of the rights of Roman citizenship, but not all, were granted the status. Citizenship could also be granted to individuals or groups by the Senate and people of Rome, or later, by the emperor for extraordinary activity or by serving the Roman army as an auxiliary for 25 years. Positions of power. There were periods in Rome's history when citizenship expanded particularly rapidly. One was during the Social War, 91 to 88 BC, the result of which was the extension of citizenship to more or less all free Italians. This had been a long time in coming. Italian allies had been fighting in Rome's wars and striving for political inclusion, but had not received any formal political rights. Eventually, Rome recognized the value of other Italians to its continued imperial success. The Social War was followed by lengthy periods of military activity by Pompey in the east and Caesar in Gaul, and individual or group grants of citizenship were made in those places. Gaul makes a particularly interesting case. In AD 48, some 100 years after those campaigns, the question was raised whether some of those Gauls conquered by Caesar should be let into the Senate. Notably, the then Emperor Claudius was himself born in Lyon, while his father, Drusus, held a post in Gaul. Claudius argued in the face of senatorial opposition that the Gallo-Romans had become so interchangeable with Italian Romans in their manners and characteristics that they deserved to sit in the empire's most prestigious political body. Two copies of Claudius's speech survive. Tacitus gives us some sense of the senator's objections. How can the same people who were once fierce enemies now be put in a position of such power? In reply, Claudius contended, "Our founder Romulus was so effective in his wisdom that he regarded many people as enemies and then as citizens on the same day. Immigrants have reigned over us. No other war was concluded in a shorter space of time than against the Gauls. Thereafter, there have been a constant and trusting peace. Now merged as they are with us by conventions, attainments, and relationships, let them bring in their gold and wealth rather than keep it to themselves." Claudius made a winning case for the ease with which the Gauls conquered by Caesar had embraced the elements of Roman citizenship, observing that this prepared them for leading roles in the Roman government. However, from the same emperor's reign, we also see the other side of this approach. Claudius is recorded by another ancient historian, Cassius Dio, writing in the 3rd century AD as having stripped someone of their citizenship for not behaving in a way that the emperor considered appropriate for a person who had been granted that status. As Ernest Carey's 1924 translation says it, Claudius reduced the Lycians to servitude because they had revolted and slain some Romans. During the investigations of this affair, which was conducted in the Senate, he put a question in Latin to one of the envoys, who had originally been a Lycian, but had been made a Roman citizen. And when the man failed to understand what was said, he took away his citizenship, saying it was not proper for a man to be a Roman who had no knowledge of the Romans' language. This story highlights an important aspect of citizenship. Acting like a citizen seems, for some emperors at least, to have been as important as the grant itself. Acting Roman. Roman identity was performed in several ways. Speaking Latin was one of them. Another was donning the correct attire. In the 2nd century AD, Pliny the Younger wrote a letter recounting the story of Valerius, who was exiled by the emperor Domitian for raping the chief priest of Vesta, Cornelia. Exile included a loss of citizen status, which meant losing the right to wear elite male Roman dress, the toga. "Have you heard that Valerius is teaching rhetoric in Sicily?" wrote Pliny, as translated by Betty Raddus in 1969. It is not long since this senator of rank was considered one of the best advocates in Rome. Now he has sunk to his present position. The senator is in exile and the orator a teacher of rhetoric. Then, when he made his entry into his new classroom, clad in a Greek cloak, those who have been ritually banished are not allowed to wear the toga, he made himself ready, looked down at his dress, and announced that he would deliver his speech in Latin. During most of the Republic, it wasn't possible to hold on to more than one citizenship at a time. Becoming Roman meant losing something else. However, in the last years of the Republic, that changed, even if sources do not provide many examples. A grant of Roman citizenship then did not automatically mean relinquishing local citizenship. Both could be held at once. For some people, Roman citizenship could have held little value in day-to-day life. Working on a local farm or operating in a local trade network did not necessarily require access to the grand operating mechanisms of empire. And a local politician with his own established network and elite status in his community did not invariably need to be eligible for the Senate in Rome to fulfill his own ambitions. Rome provides a variety of examples, lessons, and warnings about attitudes to and mechanisms of citizenship. A state that pins its own history on inclusivity can, at the same time, punish and restrict. In other words, the long history of the Roman Empire tells many stories of multiple and varied citizenships. Shushma Malik is an associate professor of classics at the University of Cambridge. You've been listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Classical British Music by D'Lo Sound. Remember, you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.